Who are you, Pat Crooks? And on the far right.
I'll turn around.
Just turn around. Very great. And to the far right is Justice Patience Robinsack, and that is our introduction. But I do want to introduce someone also in the court chambers this morning, is Representative Stephen Fries. Thank you for coming. I'm assuming these are your constituents? My assumption is correct, and that's good. I hope they pay a visit to your office while they're in the Capitol. Good. Is the instructor here with the class? Got an open invitation. What's the number of your office? You can't have anything general here. You have a specific reference to a number. Pardon me? 115 West. Right. Good. Well, thank you for coming. With those introductions made, well, by the way, there's a summary of this case available to anyone in the courtroom who has not had an opportunity to read the briefs. The marshal will provide it if you raise your hand, and they're outside in the vestibule. Okay. I'll call the first case, which is 03AP2068, State v. Charles W. Mark. Arguing on behalf of the defendant is Glenn L. Cushing, Assistant State Public Defender. Mr. Cushing.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Glenn Cushing. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender. I appear here today on behalf of Charles Mark, who was the respondent in the trial court, the appellant in the Court of Appeals, and is now the petitioner in this court. This is an appeal from a Chapter 980 commitment. After a jury trial in Jefferson County, Mr. Mark was found to be a sexually violent person within the meaning of our statutes, particularly Section 980.01 sub 7. This case presents two issues for this court to address and hopefully resolve. The first issue is whether it's proper for the state to use against the subject of a 980 petition statements he has previously given to a parole or probation agent, which statements are arguably compelled or involuntary within the meaning of this court's previous decision in State v. Evans. This issue requires this court to determine or address the extent to which our statute, 980.05 sub 1M, incorporates into Chapter 980 proceedings the constitutional rights a criminal defendant has to remain silent and to exclude at his trial statements which are compelled or involuntary. That statute briefly states that at the trial, to determine whether the person who is the subject of a petition is a sexually violent person, all rules of evidence in criminal actions apply. All constitutional rights available to a defendant in a criminal proceeding are available to the subject of the 980 proceeding. So that's the first issue. I'll probably start there, but there is a second issue which is equally important, and I hope to have time to address that. The second issue is whether the trial court committed error when it precluded Mr. Mark from introducing into evidence at the trial the restrictive conditions of supervision that he would be subject to while on probation, assuming that he were not committed under Chapter 980. In this case, Mr. Mark was going to be on probation for the next 15 years if he were not committed. And he sought to introduce the types of restrictions that he would be under in order to demonstrate that he would be less likely to reoffend, which is what the statute requires proof of. So I do hope to be able to address both of those issues. I want to start with the first one. And briefly, to summarize the facts briefly relevant to this issue, Mr. Mark gave several statements to his parole officer, in this case, he had been convicted, sentenced to prison, paroled. Then he was subsequently revoked. His parole was revoked. He was returned to prison. He then, as he approached the end of that term, is when the 980 commitment commenced. But he had previously been paroled. And, of course, my argument, I think, would be equally applicable to someone on probation. In this case, it was parole.
Mr. Cushing, before you go into the actual statements, it's my understanding that at the circuit court level, there was no objection to the admission of the testimony of the parole probation officer. In other words, there was no objection to any of these statements coming in. How do you suggest we handle the waiver issue?
Well, I was hoping that the waiver issue wasn't going to arise at this level of review. I acknowledged that when I brought this appeal, that there had been no suppression motion or no objection in the trial court. Obviously, I argued in the Court of Appeals that they had the authority to address this issue directly in the interest of justice, or because the rule of waiver is a rule of administration and not jurisdiction, that the court could simply address the issue because it continues to arise, and many times without being raised in the trial court. There is, of course, no case law until Mark was published that addresses the relevance of Evans, which says you can't use these kind of statements in a criminal case. That's fairly clear. It's been the law in the state for years. And so it hasn't been raised. It wasn't raised. The Court of Appeals accepted my argument that it should be addressed, that it was important enough to be addressed, and they addressed it on the merits. And in the petition for review, the state raised no issue regarding waiver. They did not suggest that this court should hold the issue was waived. In fact, they joined in my request for review so that we could resolve the legal issue underlying this. So I'm hopeful that, as a Chief Justice I used to know, or used to sit here, would say, you know, we didn't take this case to decide waiver. I'm hoping that this court will see that the same way, And
sometimes we do, and sometimes we don't.
Correct. I'm hoping in this case you didn't.
That's a summary of our case.
Yes. Okay. But usually it would have been raised in the petition in some way, shape, or form in order for this court to address it. And one of the reasons that I brought it in this case, and I have raised it in other cases, is that it was my opinion that the compulsion at issue here is evident in the record. It's stamped on the face of the statements that Mr. Mark gave. The threat to him from his agent, the advice, that little warning on the top of the statements, the formal statements that are at issue here, which says, you must talk to me, and I can revoke you if you don't.
Well, didn't the Court of Appeals remand this case for the determination of whether or not there really was compulsion? In other words, that whether or not it was a situation where your client basically just volunteered this information. You know, he starts out the statement saying something to the effect, I screwed up big time. So isn't there an issue in regard to that?
Well, I don't. The court, you're correct. And it gets a little complicated because there are several statements at issue. And two of them, which I want to focus on here, I kind of honed the argument down to the two formal statements that he gave to his agent that contained the written warnings. And then there was a subsequent, he was in jail, there was a subsequent admission he made that ties in with the second statement, this statement about breaking into the bathroom where this woman was. And then he was kept in jail, and several days later he made an admission to his agent. Yes, what the Court of Appeals did was create a rule, and they did this back in Zanelli 2. The Zanelli 2 case started this rule, which I think is incorrect, that you have to have two things in order to suppress a statement at a 980 trial. You have to have compulsion, and in addition, the subject has to establish that the statement would be incriminating as to some other pending or subsequent or future criminal matter. And so the Court of Appeals analyzed the statements at issue. They decided that the first statement The first formal statement that did not deal with the bathroom incident, that dealt with a different incident where he had met a woman at his church and had some contact with her. They decided that that statement wasn't incriminating. So to them, it no longer mattered whether it was involuntary, because you had to have both. So if that statement's involuntary, the Court of Appeals basically said, we don't care. It can come in because it isn't incriminating. All right. Then they went to the second statement, and they said, this one troubles us because this one, we conclude, is incriminating. So now we need the remand to determine whether it's involuntary, because then it should be excluded. Now, my position is that relatively simple, that just as in a criminal case, a criminal defendant who seeks to exclude a statement he's given has only one issue, putting aside Miranda, right? I'm not here to argue that there should be Miranda warnings. That was resolved by this court in Lombard. In any event, this is a probation parole case. He's not entitled to Miranda. So we're not talking about that. But when a criminal defendant seeks to exclude a statement on the grounds that it was involuntary, that's the sole issue. Was the statement compelled or involuntary? If it was, the state cannot use it at the trial. It does not matter what the subject matter of the statement was. It doesn't matter if it's exculpatory. I mean, if you're questioned about an armed robbery and you say that you were in Florida and you didn't do it, that's not inculpatory, that's not incriminating, it's exculpatory. But the state still cannot use that statement. If they seek to use it, they can't if it's involuntary. That is the constitutional right that a criminal defendant has. So now we have to decide, we have a statute that says the Chapter 980 people have the same constitutional rights that a criminal defendant has.
Now, but the problem is how you interpret Lombard. In Lombard, if 980 is viewed as a criminal proceeding, the Miranda was required, and the statements made would be excluded. Now you have statements made that are coerced. If you apply Lombard, why shouldn't you just say you only get the same rights as a criminal defendant gets in a criminal trial? In the statements made before trial, even if they're involuntary, you don't have those rights pre-trial under Lombard.
But I can't believe that that's what this court meant in Lombard.
We'll see, Mr.
Lombard, you know, I'm not here to re-argue Lombard.
There may be an argument
that yes, if you did it to exactly parallel, you know, you could argue that there should have been Miranda warnings. That argument has been made and rejected. But nothing in Lombard even suggests that that decision goes so far as to allow the admission of involuntary statements against the 980 subject. Because even Lombard recognizes, towards the end of Lombard, this court earlier in the first Zanelli case, Zanelli 1, the Court of Appeals recognized the right of a Chapter 980 subject to remain silent. And that case was reversed because that 980 subject did remain silent during that examination, and they brought that into evidence and used it against him. And the court said you can't do that.
But that Zanelli 1 was at trial, and there was silence commented at trial. And under the second sentence in that case, with the words at trial added like in Lombard, the right at trial is not to have silence commented on.
But how can you, they're parallel. I don't see how you could say you can't use this, if you can't use his silence against him, then you shouldn't be able to use a compelled statement against him.
Well, that's
my position. And in Lombard, I just want to read this one sentence from Lombard. Well, we recognize that Zanelli 1 stands for the proposition that a person subject to a pre-petition evaluation has the right to remain silent under the statute. We think his claim that Miranda warnings are required is too great a stretch. All right, I'll accept that. Let's say it is. It's too much of a stretch because of the difference in factual settings between a custodial police interrogation and a pre-petition examination. I'll accept that's a stretch. All right. But it's not a stretch to say that the right to remain silent guarantees you the right to exclude involuntary statements. That's my position. That's a huge difference here. In Lombard, we weren't talking about compelled. Nobody was claiming that Lombard was compelled to speak to this examiner. In fact, I think underlying the majority's position in Lombard, which that Miranda isn't required, underlying that position was the majority saying this individual was not subject to coercion or compulsion. This system was explained to him properly, and we're satisfied that his right to remain silent was properly recognized, even though we're not going to give him Miranda warnings. But when you start talking about compelling people to talk, you've gone a whole other step beyond Lombard.
Mr. Cushing, if I could, I want to kind of relate two or three of your arguments together to ask this question. You talked about the compulsion aspect in Lombard. You talked about this is a probation and parole case. And I look at the statute, which you began with, 980.05 sub 1M, and what the second sentence reads, all constitutional rights available to a defendant in a criminal proceeding are available to the person. Now, when I go back and I look at State versus Evans, and I look at Thompson, and I look at Schwartz, those are, as I understand it, the application of rules dealing with probation and parole and whether or not statements can be used at a later criminal proceeding. But I don't think there's anything in Tate, Schwartz, and Evans that says you can't use the statements in a probation or parole revocation proceeding. Now, if the 980 proceeding is akin to the probation and parole type setting, wouldn't the same type of immunity that is required in Tate, Schwartz, and Evans solve the problems with the 980 involuntary statements here?
Yes, but that would require you giving him immunity in the 980 case, and these which would mean these statements would not be admissible.
They wouldn't be admissible in a criminal trial. Would you not be able to use them in a 980 proceeding, which is after all more akin to a revocation type, after conviction type setting? I guess that's my question.
My answer is that it's more akin to a criminal case than it is to a parole revocation case. The difference is the statute itself, because just as you started your example, a person in a probation and parole situation has no right to remain silent. He has to speak to his agent. All right, that's the probation and parolee. Criminal defendant has the right to remain silent, has the right to exclude involuntary statements. Now we've added a third group. We've added the 980 people. And what we've done is given them a statute that says you're just like a criminal defendant. You have all the constitutional rights of a criminal defendant. At trial, you have the right to remain silent. One of the constitutional rights that a criminal defendant has at his trial is the right to exclude involuntary statements. My rule is, it's so simple, I think sometimes I have a hard time communicating it.
My question is this. A 980 proceeding is a civil proceeding, and it does... A person who's already been convicted and deals with all the similar type situations that you're dealing with probation and parole, where you're really trying to determine if a person after conviction is still dangerous and needs to have continued commitment, correct?
Yeah, but you should prove that with evidence that doesn't come from the person's own mouth after being forced out of them. The point is, how do you prove that? And what kind of a system do we have? Because if I want the court to be clear on the implications of this. If this court requires that in order to exclude a statement, it be both compelled and incriminating in a separate criminal case, that means that it can be compelled and involuntary as long as it's not incriminating. So that would allow the evaluators to force people to talk to them, to compel statements that could then be used at the 980 proceeding. instead of questioning them about their past crimes, the questions could be more in the light of, well, you know, isn't it true that you're a violent sexual offender? Isn't it true that you can't control your behavior anymore and that you're a sick man who needs to be locked up? Isn't that true, Mr. Mark? And if you...
Sir, isn't that what they try to find out anyway in the evaluation? I mean, they certainly don't ask questions in the way you'd phrase them, because the 980 committee would say, no, of course not, I've changed, I understand my problems. So I think what they're trying to get at is exactly the same thing, and they often use the statements of the committee in their evaluations of whether or not he continues to be sexually violent.
Can they threaten him to obtain those statements? Can they force him to talk? They're supposed to have the right to remain silent.
I don't think we put nails under their fingers.
But where do we draw that line? Do we threaten them with going to prison if they don't talk? That's what happened to Mr. Mark. He was threatened with prison if he didn't talk. That's why those statements are involuntary. That's why we don't admit him in a criminal case. What I have a problem with is the subject of the 980 proceeding, by statute, is supposed to have the same constitutional rights that a criminal defendant has. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution is a constitutional right that a criminal defendant has. It doesn't use the word incriminate. In the Fifth Amendment, you won't find that word. What the language is that no person shall be compelled to be a witness against themselves in a criminal case.
Proceeding. In a criminal proceeding.
But now we have a statute that says that same right applies in a 980 proceeding. You, Mr. 980 subject, you have the same constitutional rights at trial as a criminal defendant. Therefore, you have the right not to be compelled to be a witness against yourself. That's why we call this an adversarial system and not an inquisitorial system. That is the basis underlying the rule which allows a criminal defendant to exclude involuntary statements. We have given that right to Chapter 980 people by statute. I'm not trying to say that the Fifth Amendment all of a sudden applies to 980 people, but the legislature wrote a statute that says 980 subjects get all the constitutional rights of a criminal defendant. That's one of the most important constitutional rights that a criminal defendant has, to force the government to prove its case with its own evidence and not to use words out of his own mouth that are compelled, either legally, by torture, by force, by threat. Those are all forms of illegal compulsion that cannot be used against a criminal defendant. This would allow evaluators at the prison to compel statements, to threaten to lock people up in segregation unless they admit they need treatment. Then when they admit they need treatment, they can use it against them.
Justice Brasser has a question.
Why doesn't a person on parole or probation have the right to remain silent?
Oh, because we took it away from them. And because our system of probation and parole, when this was recognized in the U.S. Supreme Court in Minnesota versus Murphy, basically allowed the states to take away the right to remain silent, but to replace it with immunity, thus granting to the probation and parolee the protection from having his compelled statements used against him.
Criminal proceeding, but not in parole revocation.
Correct, but a parole revocation, right. But the difference between a person being revoked and a 980 subject is the 980 subject has the right to remain silent. There's a statute that says a Chapter 9...
And but in response to Justice Prosser.
Correct, that's correct. A probation and parolee can have his involuntary statements used against him to revoke him. Okay? It can be done, but...
Suppose somebody is in the prison. Does that person have a right to remain silent?
Well, yes. If they're being interrogated by the police with regard to a crime, they're in custody. They have the right to remain silent.
Okay, and so if you're in prison, you have the right to remain silent.
Well,
but if you are released on parole, your status has changed a little bit. It's sort of like a privilege, isn't it?
Well, I'm not – you're clearly correct. The problem is – this is what causes the whole problem, is that when you're on parole, you don't have the right to remain silent. But a criminal defendant does, and a 980 subject does. So all I'm trying to do – this seemed so simple to me when I first found this issue. I thought, here we have a rule, State versus Evans. It's been the rule for 20, 30 years, that if you're compelled to give a statement to an agent, it's inadmissible because it's involuntary. It's inadmissible. No, that's all there is to it. Now we have a statute that says Chapter 980 subjects have all the rights of criminal defendants. I thought, well, this makes perfect sense then, because this is a compelled statement, and if it wouldn't be admissible at a criminal trial, why should it be admissible at a 980 trial?
Well, what about compelling a prisoner to make statements regarding prison discipline for something that happens in the prison?
Right. Well, whenever you're applying the Fifth Amendment, let's stop for a minute.
Fifth Amendment apply under those.
Let's just do this at its basic level. Because what the state is really saying is that this statute, which supposedly gives him a constitutional right to remain silent, means nothing because all he has is the same rights that everybody has in a civil case. And that right is not to be compelled to say something which would incriminate you in a criminal case. That's what the Fifth Amendment says. In any proceeding, a witness at a car accident case can invoke the Fifth Amendment. It's applicable in civil proceedings. But those people, the defendant or the plaintiff in a car accident case, doesn't have a statute which says you have all the rights of a criminal defendant. A probationer and a parolee doesn't have a statute that says you have all the rights of a criminal defendant. Only the subject of a 980 petition has that special statute which gives him the same rights as a criminal defendant.
And you have tried very hard to line up Zanelli 1, Zanelli 2, and Lombard, right? Because you don't want to compel.
I think it got off track in Zanelli 2, and I'm trying to explain what went wrong there.
All right. It seems to me that the heart of the controversy here is explained in footnote 9 in the Court of Appeals decision, which says, in effect, tries to merge Mel.
The decision in this case, in my case.
In Mark. I mean, the state appears, and I'm going to ask the state, to agree that clarification in the case law is needed. I mean, at least you both agree that it might be needed.
Correct.
Zanelli 1, 2, and Lombard. You just disagree as to what the clarification should be.
Well, I have a pretty clear position on what it should be, and it's a fairly simple one. I mean, really, my rule is a very simple rule. That is, you don't use compelled statements in a 980 case. That's my rule. And you don't go through the second level of complicated analysis trying to figure out whether some statement is incriminating in another case. And I want to remind this Court that the United States Supreme Court in Rhode Island versus Ennis said the definition of incriminating is anything the state wants to use against you. And that's basically what I'm trying to say, is that this Court feels like, well, the statement, once they begin to use it against you, they should be precluded from doing that if it's involved.
Isn't the problem...
Just,
I know you red lights. The problem is you want a blanket, you want a complete prohibition against all statements. I mean,
that are involuntary.
Well, and that's the problem, because as I think Justice Crooks pointed out, in this case, it appears that there may be some that are not.
Well, I would agree.
Category, and that's the problem, because in a 980, statements are. I mean, they're commonly used. I think this is going to have a profound effect on a 980.
Criminal courts do this every day.
I understand that.
And they have the same rights as a criminal defendant. I'm not saying, I want it clear, the state tried to argue in their brief that I'm trying to exclude every statement that a subject of a 980 makes. That's absolutely not true, Justice Wilcox. All I want is a rule from this Court that involuntary statements cannot be used. That's all. That isn't going to preclude 95% of the statements that the state uses in 980 cases. This comes up because of parole supervision. Once they're in prison, there's very little evidence that any form of compulsion or threats or anything which would make statements involuntary rarely, if ever, arises during the evaluation process. This isn't going to preclude the use of statements during treatment in the prison. This is a very limited, narrow class of statements that are at issue. I think that's important for the court to recognize, because I never have argued that all statements that an individual makes are inadmissible. All I want is the same rule from Evans that you apply to criminal cases. That's basically the rule I propose.
Thank you, Mr. Cushing. Warren D. Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
I'm Warren Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state in this case. I want to start by emphasized by quoting from the U.S. Supreme Court last term. It's a case I didn't cite in my brief because the proposition's been stated over and over and over, and I cited later cases. But as late as 2004 term, in Hibble versus 6th Judicial District Court of Nevada at 542 U.S. 177, the quote comes from page 189, to qualify for Fifth Amendment privilege, a communication must be three things: testimonial, incriminating, and compelled. That's what the Fifth Amendment protects. Why do we not deal with incriminating in a criminal case? Because the Innis definition makes any statement offered by the state by definition incriminating. But this statute's an imperfect fit when you go to a commitment proceeding, because there's a lot of evidence, and there are one statement in this case, in which the statement does not deal with criminal behavior, but it's relevant to whether or not this person is dangerous. Other statements, which don't have anything to do with criminal activity at all, go to whether or not the person has a mental disease or defect.
Now, wasn't that what counsel was saying? My question on the blanket prohibition, and he said, no, I don't want that, because 95% would fall in the category that you're talking about.
Well, I think what he's saying is that if a statement is compelled in the sense of the probation and parole warning that this can't be used, you have to make this statement or we'll revoke you, that any statement, even if it deals with only mental disease or defect, even if it deals with only dangerous, it has nothing to do with any criminal activity, and I suggest that the statement dealing with the incident on the porch has nothing to do with any criminal activity of any kind, that statement may not come in. What he has done, it seems to me, in that view, is convert the civil commitment proceeding into a criminal proceeding.
Let me just ask you a question on that.
Yeah.
One, is this testimonial? I want to see if it fits into the...
I don't think there's any question that he...
It's testimony, right?
I'm sorry?
It's testimonial.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it compelled?
Well, I think that if...
You'd have a hard statement saying that under threat of
right.
imprisonment, this
right.
is not compelled.
The problem with the one statement that Mr. Cushing focused on is that the record appears to indicate that perhaps Mr. Mark came in without being asked.
Okay.
And if that happens, I think it's not compelled.
That's voluntary. If he's asked, it's compelled. Okay. So we're left with incriminating.
Right?
That's the key issue here, if you want to get it under the Fifth.
In my view, it is, yeah.
Okay. So for the moment, now is the state using these testimonial compelled statements against the defendant?
In a civil proceeding, yes.
But they are using it.
Well, if you use the Innis definition. The state offered them in the 980.
Contrary to the interests of the defendant.
I'm sorry?
Contrary to the interests of the defendant. And you're saying, yeah, but it's a civil proceeding, right? That's your defense.
No.
Okay.
My defense is it has to, in addition to being, because this is a civil proceeding, it has to deal with criminal conduct. In my view, Lombard rejected the proposition that a 980 proceeding is a criminal proceeding for purposes of the statute.
And that's the same thing that they're trying to say. I accept that. Namely, you can't have anything incriminating in 980 because it's civil.
Right.
So your position is whatever you use against the defendant, even if it's testimonial and compelled, by definition is not incriminating because this is a civil proceeding, and that the most that can happen to him, he's a Chapter 980 sexual offender, and he's subject to, incarceration.
Provided he doesn't deal with criminal behavior.
Institutionalization, perhaps, for the rest of his life. That's
provided he doesn't deal with criminal behavior.
Well, we're assuming.
Well, I mean, and I think that's important because without the statute, by the way, the statute's much broader than the Fifth Amendment. The statute encompasses a lot of rights that don't have anything to do with the Fifth Amendment, like the right to present a defense, the right to be competent in trial, the right not to be called as a witness, the right to have a unanimous verdict. That's all. So I don't think it's fair to say that the statute's superfluous, even if we bar, quote-unquote, compelled statements that are not incriminating.
Suppose it was an incriminating, compelled testimonial statement. Can you use it at a 980 proceeding?
If it's incriminating, in what definition?
Your definition.
If it deals with future criminal conduct, no. For instance, if the statement about, I've changed on reflection, I've reconsidered my view from what I argued in the brief, that the statement about the residential hotel was not incriminating, because first of all, the statute hasn't run on that, even if it's only a misdemeanor, but I can see that the second statement might be used, although it would be a very weak case in my view, to proceed on a sexual assault. So that case, if that statement deals with a crime for which Mr. Mark has not yet been prosecuted and can be prosecuted, if it's compelled, then I don't think that can be used in a 980 proceeding. But statements like the one dealing with the woman on the porch are statements, and there was another statement, by the way, that was at issue, that Mr. Mark made to his parole agent dealing with the victim of his crime for which he had already been convicted, and he cannot be prosecuted for that crime again. That's not incriminating, and that is fair game in a civil proceeding like this.
Mr. Weinstein, if I could ask, you focus on the term incriminating and your definition of it. My question is whether or not the United States Supreme Court, in a civil proceeding, has ever defined incriminating differently than they defined it in Rhode Island versus Ennis.
Yeah, well, they don't have to reach the question, and the reason is because under Minnesota versus Murphy, if it doesn't deal with criminal behavior, it can come in. Incriminating in, and this, by the way, is also used in Evans, deals with criminal conduct. So there's a footnote in Murphy that says, I cited it in the brief, but the number of the footnote escapes me at the moment. But it says, if what's compelled here is a statement about residential location, which has no bearing on, on criminal activity, there's no problem on the Fifth Amendment with that kind of a statement because it doesn't deal with criminal activity.
If you're talking about footnote 7,
I think it might be, yeah.
It wasn't that really dealing with whether or not one must assert a privilege or not?
Well, I don't think so. And that's one of the reasons I wrestled with this, whether or not Mr. Mark had to assert it. Normally, what we think when we think about this, we think about it in the process of testimony in a civil case. And a question comes up that may call on the witness to incriminate him or herself. And in that kind of a situation, we require the witness to assert the Fifth Amendment. And if they just answer the question, that's considered to be a waiver or voluntary, however you want to view that. And if a valid Fifth Amendment privilege is asserted to that question, then it falls on either the state or the court or somebody to immunize the individual such that the answer to the statement can't be used, and then the person must answer the question. In a parole and probation situation, we compress all of this, and I think what Minnesota versus Murphy stands for is that if you have a warning like's on the statements in this case, that the Fifth Amendment is, even though it's a civil proceeding, the Fifth Amendment is no longer self-executing.
What about the language, though, of the Fifth Amendment itself? And I'm going to the pertinent language. Nor shall be compelled in any criminal case. I think everybody's agreed that the statute applies constitutional rights in the setting. In any criminal case, to be a witness against himself. To be a witness against himself would seem to be consistent, if I'm reading Rhode Island versus Ennis correctly, with the Rhode Island versus Ennis definition that anything the state wants to use, if they're compelling you to give the statement, they're forcing you to be a witness against yourself. So if you could respond to Mr. Cushing's argument, because I think that's his point.
Yeah, I think that is his point. But the problem is, that's in my view, that's an imperfect fit unless you believe, and I don't think, and Lombard seemed to say no, that the legislature in this case intended for the state not to be able to offer statements that have nothing to do with criminal activity in a 980 proceeding. If the legislature did not intend to convert the 980 proceeding into a criminal proceeding for the purpose of this statute, then it seems to me that you can't conclude that any statement, no matter what it deals with, is barred because it's not voluntary.
Would we have to find that the statute was ambiguous to get at that legislative intent?
Well, I don't...
Because the plain meaning says the same rights apply.
Well, Lombard's already resolved the question, I think, and that is that the legislature didn't intend to convert the 980 proceeding into a criminal proceeding. So then it seems to me you're bound to say, if that's true, what we have to analyze what the statement deals with in order to determine whether or not it's incriminating. Because if you get away from the incriminating aspect, then you've given the 980 defendant more than what, at least Hibble says, is required by the Fifth Amendment. Because Hibble requires that the statement also be incriminating, and other cases too, Minnesota versus Murphy.
Counsel, I want to focus on the definition of incriminating. Let's say it's a 980 case, and we're talking about statements that are very, I'll say, damaging to a 980 committee, but are not incriminating under the definition of Czarnecki 2. The statements are, every morning when I get up, I I daydream. And I daydream about having sexual intercourse with young children. Woo! You know, I mean, a 980, put them behind bars forever. I mean, that's... But isn't that criminal activity, is it? You know,
no.
I mean, that this, so, yeah. So if he was, and it was under the circumstance if he was on parole, and that if he didn't tell his agent everything, he would be subject to being reincarcerated, ergo compelled. He's compelled to tell this to his agent. Under your definition, that is Zarnelli 2, will that statement come in?
I think it will. And I think you have to be careful because the parole and probation situation is not the only situation in which this, a decision that anything that's relevant to dangerousness or mental disease is barred if it's not voluntary, because we use a lot of statements from PSIs, and if the compulsion is there for a parole and probation, it seems to me it's equally there for a PSI, because I mean you're not put away in quite as direct a way, but if you lie in a PSI and you get caught, you can be pretty sure that the circuit judge is going to increase the penalty.
So you can be forced to make very damaging statements. You know, again, I'm using the word damaging rather than incriminating. Very damaging that, and you can be forced to make those damaging statements, but those forced damaging statements under your definition of incriminating still could come in. Under the innest definition, they wouldn't be able to come in, I would guess, likely. Used against
if you apply the innest definition to this civil proceeding in the same way, yes, it would.
I have one other question. I want to focus on the second written statement. And that dealt
I'm sorry, which one?
In my mind, that dealt with the woman, the hotel incident.
Okay,
pushing
yeah.
the door for 5 to 10 minutes, trying to get into the bathroom where she
right.
is, and she... Now, that was a written statement. Was that compelled?
Well, that's the one I don't know for sure because it starts, the written part starts, I screwed up big time, which kind of indicates, at least the set that we argued in the Court of Appeals and the Court of Appeals agreed, that there was a reasonable inference that he volunteered that. Now, one could say, well, you volunteer to a parole agent, isn't that sufficient compulsion since you know that you're supposed to tell the truth? But if we adopt that kind of definition of compulsion, then it seems to me we run up against the U.S. Supreme Court case law that says compulsion to tell the truth after an oath or compulsion to tell the truth on a subpoena is insufficient compulsion under the Fifth Amendment. So that's what the problem is. And so,
is there anything on these written statements, you know, I mean, that say you must tell the truth, and if you don't tell the truth, you will be subject to revocation and put back behind bars? Is there, you know, in bold print, disclaimer to the consumer?
in the written part of the statements, I think this was what Mr. Cushing was referring to, there is a warning at the top, the effect of, I'm not sure what
yeah.
the exact word
I'm
is, but that's the effect of it, yes.
Okay.
But if the statement's already voluntarily made before the written statement, I mean, these parolees have recurring regular appointments. So if the parolee comes into his parole agent, sits down and says, I screwed up big time, and proceeds to say that, and then the parole agent says, okay, now I need a written statement, it's our view that that's still not compelled, even if you believe that had he come in, sat down, and the parole agent said, oh, I hear you did this thing, and he says, yeah, I did, and then that's compulsion. I think under Mr. Cushing's view,
and I would agree with it on that. Now, the reason there's ambiguity in this case is the record seems to indicate that he may have volunteered this without being questioned. And that would make a difference, in my view at least, and I guess in the Court of Appeals' view also, on whether or not this was a compelled statement.
The definition of a sexually violent person includes the propensity for future activity, that is,
right.
Dangerousness. If the agent asked the 980 committee who's on parole, are you dangerous? Do you think you're dangerous because you have these daydreams every day? And he said, yes. And do you think that you're going to do it again in the future? If we didn't have you in this halfway house, would you think you'd do it and weren't under supervision? And he says, probably. Are those statements able to be used against him?
Well, setting aside that there may be other objections to those questions, like that invades the province of the jury.
Yeah, that's right. Out.
That
objection no longer exists.
Yeah, I think those are admissible. And in fact, if you look at a footnote in Kansas versus Hendricks, you'll see that Mr. Hendricks, I don't know whether it was in the state's case or not, but because it doesn't say, but it quotes his testimony, which essentially says that very same thing.
How do you mesh that with our statute that says you have the same rights as a criminal defendant at trial, and of course that right is not to have your, assuming compelled statements, used against you or used to incriminate you? And certainly they would incriminate,
if it's incriminating, I don't think there's, I think even.
If a person says, I admit to all of the elements of definition of sexual violent offender, the sexual violent person, I mean, that's incriminating. I don't care it's incriminating if the whole issue is he a sexually violent person? You know, is he going to reoffend? Is he dangerous? If those are the issues and he admits it, I don't care about Zanelli. Do it. I don't care about Innes. I mean, it seems to me that it's incriminating. See Webster's Dictionary.
Well, except that you have converted the 980 proceeding into a criminal case.
You don't
agree. For purposes of that statute.
You don't agree with Justice Bradley that they're incriminating. You would think they're damaging.
Right.
Not incriminating.
Right.
Because Chapter 980 is civil.
And because the legislature did not intend to bar, by adopting that statute, what I think the legislature intended was to keep out statements that the state could use in future criminal proceedings.
You think it's like an auto accident. So if the person in the auto accident, the defendant, the alleged tortfeasor, tells the world in a written statement to the newspaper, I was negligent, I drove over the speed limit for no good reason, I knew I was doing that, blah, 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 that statement could be used against him in court. Because it may be damaging in a civil case, but not incriminating criminally. I mean, assuming that there's no criminal charge.
Are you talking about offering it in a civil
auto accident case.
Yeah. Now, the problem is that we now have statutes that criminalize negligent behavior.
I know. Well, I'm going to get out of that. And so
okay.
Setting those aside. There's no charge, none expected, et cetera.
It's not reasonably foreseeable that there'll be a criminal charge.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Then that would come in a civil tort case.
And I can present the question as to, the victim
right.
was really damaged. He is hurt. The medicals
right.
are over 300. All these admissions against interest would be allowed in.
Right. They would in a civil case. And likewise, as the Supreme Court notes in Murphy, a confession of a rule violation in a probation and parole hearing, which doesn't deal with criminal behavior, is not protected by the Fifth Amendment.
Counselor, you said you've changed your position a little bit since your brief. Given that shift, what would you like our decision to look like if you were writing it?
I think at this point, in my view, you can just affirm the exact decision of the Court of Appeals, i.e., two of the statements are admissible. The third state are the combination of two statements, which they dealt with together as a third statement, must be remanded to determine whether or not they were voluntary. And I think the question in that remand is, did he volunteer them, excuse me, by just coming in and without being asked or anything, just blurted out? And if he didn't, then I think it is involuntary. If
the affirmance, because on the second issue, which you haven't discussed yet, or
that's the discretionary evidentiary.
Your position.
Yes, and I think that's correct. That was correct also. But unless you have some specific questions about it, I'll.
Justice Prosser has a question for you.
Concentrate on the Fifth Amendment.
If we were to affirm the Court of Appeals, then why isn't waiver an important issue here?
Well, the reason we didn't raise waiver in the petition or in our response to the petition for two reasons. First of all, I agree with Mr. Cushing and with the Court of Appeals that the Zanelli cases and Lombard are confusing. I think that Zanelli 2 is correct. I think the problem with Zanelli 1 is that they reached a different conclusion than Lombard, that someone at an evaluation stage has a Fifth Amendment privilege. Now, I think it's, as a matter of practice, not because of the Fifth Amendment, people who, the evaluators, will not require somebody to undergo an interview. So they'll say, do you want to talk to me? And if the person says no, they honor that without regard to the Fifth Amendment. So to the extent Zanelli says a comment on refusing to talk at trial is a violation, that makes sense, but it still a little inconsistent in the sense that if the guy doesn't have a right to remain silent, why shouldn't you be able to comment on it? From the state's point of view, we can live with that. But I think clearly if somebody exercises their right to silence, so, for instance, during the course of an evaluation, the evaluator talks about prior victims, and the person says, well, I don't want to talk about that because they may still prosecute me for those, then I think a comment at trial on that is prohibited by the Fifth Amendment, and to that extent, Zanelli 1 is correct. But to the extent that it also says there is an automatic right that far ahead of proceedings to remain silent, I think it's directly in conflict with Lombard.
Mr. Weinstein, if I could, I want to go back to the statute for a minute, 980.05 sub 1M, and ask you the same question I asked Mr. Cushing. The statute reads, all constitutional rights available to a defendant in a criminal proceeding are available to that person. Now, when you look at these proceedings, if you have it in the Evans, Schwartz, Thompson cases, you have statements that are made that can be used at a probation and parole proceeding but can't be used in a subsequent criminal action, and that's where the offer of immunity comes in. We also understand that 980 is a civil proceeding, and I guess my question is this similar enough to a probation and parole situation so that this statute could be interpreted in a manner similar to Evans, Schwartz, and Thompson?
I think it could. And I think, frankly, you could argue that because the first sentence there, which says that the individual has, that the rules of evidence in a criminal case apply, one could argue that because Evans automatically, without having, without the judge or the prosecutor having to do anything, established an immunity, that Evans applied through that statute automatically establishes the immunity. We didn't make that argument. Frankly, I didn't think of it. But I think that that is a reasonable argument to be made. And I think that would be a reasonable interpretation of the statute. I think that would go further to accomplishing what the legislature had in mind with that statute than a blanket. You can't use any damaging statement, even if it doesn't involve criminal activity.
I'm not sure you can get a legislative intent out of the statute.
Well, that may well be true.
Counsel, it seems as if there's agreement between you and the defendant that we got a slight problem. You might, some may characterize it broader, among Zanelli 1, Zanelli 2, and Lombard. You think Zanelli 1 doesn't quite fit with Lombard, but Lombard cited Zanelli 1 and didn't object to it. In fact, thought it was a terrific case.
Yeah, I realize that.
So my question to you is, if you had the opportunity to write this case, how would you clarify the relationship and the meaning of Zanelli 1, Zanelli 2, and Lombard so they all fit together, so that litigants and trial courts and the Court of Appeal would not be faced with the issue that the Court of Appeals in this case explained in that footnote?
The way I would do it is I would say that Zanelli 1 is correct to the extent that it says that if someone exercises a right to silence, the prosecutor can't comment on it at trial. I think what I think is the faulty reasoning or the faulty premise in Zanelli 1 is saying the person has a Fifth Amendment right at the evaluation, because to me that's what's inconsistent with Lombard. Because if the person had a Fifth Amendment right at the evaluation, it seems to me Lombard had to come out the other way.
Okay. What about Zanelli 2?
Now, Zanelli 2, I think, is correct. And that is, statements that don't involve criminal activity are not barred in a 980 case because they are not incriminating. Or, if they happen to be voluntary, that's another requirement. But that statements in are only barred if they are both, assuming they're testimonial, and almost all of these statements that we're talking about, in not only these, but in general way, are almost all testimonial.
How do you interpret Lombard?
They must be both incriminating and compelled.
So you're agreeing with Lombard. I mean,
I agree with Lombard. I agree with Zanelli 2. I would only modify Zanelli 1 to the extent that it holds that you have a Fifth Amendment right to silence at an evaluation that occurs years maybe before the petition's filed.
Here's my problem with your analysis. Under Lombard, the court limited the defendant's rights to at trial, not rights that come before trial. Is that a valid interpretation of Lombard? I mean, it says that.
I think, yeah, it did say that, and I think it's correct.
All right. But in Zanelli 1, the right to remain silent, not the right, you didn't have that right in Zanelli, under your premise, but an exercise of the right to silence, which you didn't have under the Fifth Amendment, somehow protected you at trial. How can that be? You didn't have a Fifth Amendment right, according to you, before trial. But somehow you say, I don't have this right under the Fifth Amendment, but I ain't talking, okay? Now you get to trial, and they want to use your silence against you when you didn't even have a Fifth Amendment right. And Zanelli says, oh, you can't do that. In an auto accident case, if you remain silent under questioning by the insurance company or someone else makes an accusation, you can use silence as an indication that you're guilty or whatever. So that doesn't make sense to me. That's my problem in a nutshell.
If the problem, it seems to me, in Zanelli is that
Zanelli
it was a broad exercise of the Fifth Amendment. There may well have been, or what the Zanelli one court viewed as the Fifth Amendment.
Yeah, but you don't.
I agree with you that it's inconsistent to say if you don't have any Fifth Amendment right at all,
right,
then why can't the prosecutor comment on it? But the problem is that you do have a Fifth Amendment right under the U.S. Supreme Court precedents if the questions call for incriminating behavior. Now, if we have a situation...
But did they in Zanelli 1? You don't know.
I'm sorry?
Did they in Zanelli 1?
We don't know because he just said, I'm not talking to you at all. We don't have any idea what the subject matter of the interview was going to be other than the general evaluation, and the Court of Appeals determined that there was a Fifth Amendment right to do that. Well, I would say it's right and it's wrong. It's wrong to the extent that what the evaluator was going to ask him about was his mental disease and dangers having nothing to do with criminal behavior. But if he was also going to ask him about some criminal behavior, then it's true that he does have a right to say, I'm not going to answer
that. So Zanelli 1 has to be limited by this court.
That's right. I think Zanelli 1 has to be limited.
And if it's not limited, it's inconsistent.
I'm sorry?
If it's not limited, it's inconsistent with Lombard, according to your analysis.
And Zanelli 2, yeah.
Right. Okay.
Right. But it has to be limited. And if someone exercises their Fifth Amendment right to silence at an evaluation, it's a valid assertion of the privilege, then I don't think the prosecutor can comment on it at trial. And to that extent, Zanelli 1's right.
All right. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I need to follow up on that.
I'm sorry.
Justice Breyer. One asserts the Fifth Amendment at the evaluation stage, and the prosecutor can't comment on it, yet it is a violation of their conditions of parole, then how do you get, what does the jury hear at the trial? And in other words, you're saying that a person...
No, I'm saying if the person exercises their right, what Zanelli condemned was when the guy wouldn't talk to the evaluator.
Right.
The prosecutor argued, you can use his silence as evidence that he was... Well, I don't know exactly what it's supposed to indicate, whether it's dangerousness or mental disease or whatever, but you can use that against him in some way. And I think if what the question called for was criminal activity, which is not the case in Zanelli, it was a very broad assertion, but if there was a question that called for a prospective person to...
Okay.
To say something that was an element of the crime, and the person did exercise his Fifth Amendment, which Mr. Marks didn't, for reasons that we're disputing here, then I think the prosecutor can't comment. That's the same as a criminal case, where the person exercises the Fifth Amendment right pre-trial, and the prosecutor tries to comment on that to infer guilt.
I got you. All right, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Cushing.
Thank you. I almost don't know where to start. I don't have long enough to do this, and I'm going to try not to repeat myself. But there's a couple of problems here. And we have a statute that says subjects of 980 petitions have all the constitutional rights of criminal defendants. We have a very well-developed body of law defining the constitutional rights of criminal defendants. It's beyond dispute that a criminal defendant has a constitutional right under the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution to exclude at his trial involuntary or compelled statements without regard to the subject of those statements or the topic discussed. So my position is that our statute is unambiguous. This Court has so held several times that this statute is unambiguous and that it incorporates the constitutional rights of a criminal defendant. Therefore, the subject of a Chapter 980 petition has a constitutional right incorporated by statute, the same right that a criminal defendant has to exclude at his trial involuntary or compelled statements, period, without regard to the subject matter of the statement, because the state is seeking to use against him at the trial his own compelled words. The fundamental principle underlying the constitutional right is the language of the Fifth Amendment, which says that no person shall be compelled to be a witness against themselves. I understand that that constitutional provision, by its own terms, is solely applicable to criminal cases. But the principle is you don't compel him to be a witness against himself. That's the principle that underlies our system. We have an adversarial system. The state must prove its case without forcing evidence from the lips of the defendant or the subject of a 980 petition. We have given to 980 subjects additional rights that the participants in most civil proceedings do not have. And yet the state wishes to give to Mr. Mark only the protection that all other civil subjects of civil proceedings have. And that's my problem with this. And what they always want to say is, oh, he wants to convert this to a criminal trial. Now, if you grant this right, you are converting 980 into a criminal trial. That is simply not true. We give the subjects of 980 petitions multiple constitutional rights that a criminal defendant has. The right to a unanimous jury verdict, the right to be represented by counsel, the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses, the right to, you know, subpoena witnesses, all types of the same constitutional rights that a criminal defendant has, we give to a 980 subject. That hasn't converted them into criminal proceedings. We haven't barred locking these people up for the rest of their life on double jeopardy grounds.
Mr. Cushing, here's the problem that I've got, and I hope you can help me with it. The purpose of the 980 proceeding is to determine whether or not the individual who's already been convicted of a criminal offense is still dangerous, is a sexually violent, dangerous person. Oftentimes, that evidence is necessarily going to come from the individual. It comes from the person who is the subject of the proceeding. And you're looking at that person's behavior, background, character. You're looking at the whole panoply of that individual to determine whether that individual is dangerous. So I guess my question, and I've been trying to get at this a couple of times during the proceeding, is does the nature of the proceeding, the 980 proceeding, make a difference in how the statute should be interpreted?
No. In my opinion, no. The statute gives to these subjects the protections a criminal defendant has, and it does so for a reason, because this isn't like any other civil proceeding. We have taken the force of the government, and we are using it to deprive an individual of their liberty based on science, which is questionable, based on predicting their behavior in the future, and we can lock them up maybe for the rest of their life. And therefore, you can use any statements of my client you want, you can use any behavior of his you want, you can use any history of his you want, but you should not be able to use words you have forced by compulsion from him. And that's where I think this Court should draw a line. And I have to comment on one thing, because there's this, and Justice Wilcox brought it up before, about, well, you won't be able to use any statements these people make, and counsel for the state brought up statements in a PSI. Well, let's not get confused here. Statements in a PSI are not compelled. I have never, ever argued that they were. No criminal defendant is compelled to speak to a PSI agent, and no criminal defendant is punished for not speaking to an author of a PSI report. That isn't the issue here. We're talking about a very limited, narrow set of statements, and the defendant would always have to prove that they were involuntary statements. Justice Abrams' example of the car accident victim who gives a story to the newspaper. Well, that's not a compelled statement. That's a voluntary statement. And even my client can make voluntary statements that can be used against him. I'm not saying that you can't use statements made during treatment, during evaluations, at all different times in their life. Subjects of these petitions will make statements that can be used against them. All I seek is a simple rule that's the same one we apply to criminal defendants.
Seems to me the line between you and the state is incriminating. You only want to apply involuntary standard?
Yes.
And the state wants involuntary plus incriminating.
Because
incriminating me subject you to a criminal prosecution.
That's their definition.
Okay.
Mine is if they use it against you.
Yours is damage, to use
correct.
Justice Bradley's terminology.
And it's the same definition that the cases that interpret the Due Process Clause use when they are evaluating the admissibility of an involuntary statement for a criminal defendant.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cushing, and thank you, Mr. Weinstein, for an interesting argument once again in interpreting Chapter 980 and the meaning of that one sentence in that section relating to constitutional rights. That concludes the hearing on the 03-AP-2068. The court will take a few moments in recess so that the Barneville students may leave and Fort Atkinson High School students may come back in, if the Barneville students want to leave.